Cellist Jonah Kim and pianist Sean Kennard were barely teenagers when they went off to study at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. Looking back, they said it was kind of like being at Hogwarts. Every time they would learn something new, they were just mesmerized by the spells they could cast with the new flashy techniques they were learning. 2 decades later, they're still performing together. They've grown into musical wizards, and they've just released their debut recording. It features the cello sonatas of Rachmaninoff and Barber, and these works they first played when they were just young students at Curtis. You'll find out more in this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. I'm talking with cellist Jonah Kim and pianist Sean Kennard about their new recording, which features cello sonatas by Rachmaninoff and Barber. I want to start off by just asking each of you to introduce yourselves. Tell me just a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you fell in love with your instrument of choice, and anything else that you think our listeners should know about you as individuals. Sean, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Sean Kennard, pianist. I started playing when I was 10 years old in Hawaii, where I grew up. I went to the Curtis Institute of Music, where I met my good friend Jonah Kim, who we recorded the album with. And now I teach at Stetson University in DeLand, Florida.
So there's a big gaping hole there between when you're 10 and when you go to Curtis.
Yeah, not such a big hole, actually, because I started at Curtis when I was 13.
Did you grow up in a family of musicians? How did you fall in love with the piano?
My family was not a family of musicians. My dad's an airline pilot. He's retired now. And I was homeschooled, so my parents thought that I should have some sort of musical training. So they got a digital piano, and my dad taught me to read music because he'd taken piano lessons when he was younger. And I just took off with it and really enjoyed it and asked for lessons. So I took my first lesson on my 10th birthday, exactly.
Wow. So you made a lot of progress in just a short period of time. Practicing was easy for you.
I wouldn't say it was easy to practice, but I really loved it and was dedicated to it from the beginning. I feel I was very lucky to know that I wanted to play the piano as a career almost right from the beginning.
Wow. Jonah, how about you?
My name is Jonah Kim, cellist, and really happy to talk with you guys about how we came to conceive the recording and our journey into, I guess, making the recording. I started the cello way back when I was like 6-7 years old back in Korea before I immigrated to this country with my parents. They are very musical, but are not musicians. My mother was a runway model. So she's very into the performing, and she's, you know, used to being in the public eye and things like that. She passed on to me. And my father is completely from the other end of the social spectrum, I guess. He's a pastor, a theologian, and I guess that's very different from a runway model, right? Because all of my friends were like, how does that even work? You know, like, what are your family dynamics like? What do you even talk about over dinner, right? Because my parents are so seemingly different by trade, but, you know, they're inseparable and they work really well together. So it's actually watching them interact is like a lesson in all kinds of things, including like music making and like rehearsal dynamics and like contract negotiations. And anyway, it's kind of a fun time at home. But, you know, we didn't have like a musician at home, but we like always listened to music. So it was as though we had like a live-in, like Pablo Casals was living in our house all the time, and like Rostropovich was like living in our house all the time. So I grew up thinking that these people were much closer to me than they were actually, because Casals, I think, passed away even before I was born. And even to this day, in my mind, he's my first teacher, because before I went to a conservatory and got my first teacher, I didn't have a real teacher. I played for, you know, cellists here and there, especially like musicians who went through my father's church. I played for them, but I didn't have like a private instructor. So I practiced and I watched videotapes of Casals, and I learned that way. And then I went to Juilliard, I went to Curtis. I guess I met Sean at Curtis when I was like 13 or 14 years old. And maybe we met even before that, but you know, we were so little. We were so young and everybody else was much older. So there wasn't that much of like a social element until we were like 12, 13, 14 years old. And then we started hanging out, and the Rachmaninoff actually was the very first piece we played together. So years later, what's it, like 15 years later, almost 20 years later, to record this together, and especially to like record this along the Rachmaninoff along with the Barber, which is another really special piece for us. It's been an adventure, a learning experience, and a bit of grace, like the silver lining on 2020 that's just kind of kept us going. So we're very grateful.
I want to talk more about the individual pieces, but first I have a couple more questions for each of you. Jonah, have you already earned 2 Grammy Awards?
Well, yes, but you know, like, here's the thing about awards, right? And about these things is it's all teamwork. And here's the greatest thing about music is the working together bit. I actually released a recording years and years ago that I recorded with Leo Kwokman. He's a fantastic conductor, and he was also at Curtis with us, and he's everywhere now. He's a fantastic conductor. So we made this recording based on the work of Langston Hughes. And we had actually, my friends from Interlaken were also in on this project. And so we had all kinds of elements, like, you know, artists of color, women composers, and our engineer at Skywalker also was fantastic. And this incredible team came together, and we managed to win a couple of awards. Hopefully, we can make more meaningful recordings and make meaningful, impactful art that's relevant to, you know, not just us musicians, but everybody. And, you know, that's sort of how we feel about this Rachmaninoff Barber recording as well. It's not just about our music. It's like, how is this music still relevant now, 100 years later? And who wants to listen to this and why? What does the story tell? What does it mean for us now? What are we supposed to feel? You know, and I feel like in 2020, with all of these things happening and all of these meaningful changes, life is changing. I mean, like, I have a 3-year-old now, so my perspective on life is very different. And I did an interview with Interlaken talking about a very similar thing, how we made music then and how we make the same music now and how the same music is so different. But that's, I think, life is like that in many ways, right? Something that was correct for me when I was 12 years old, definitely not right for me now.
I wanted to ask you about your 3-year-old and how having a 3-year-old, especially during a global pandemic, how has your world changed?
For me, she is like the beacon of hope, you know, that I need so much. And seeing my daughter, I see elements of myself, and I see elements that are not me. And I wonder, like, she is 3 years old. How can she be more like me than me, and yet better than me in almost every single way? And it's so easy for her. She's able to dream dreams that are bigger than anything I could have fathomed, just from being alive now and not 30, however many years ago. So I am so hopeful. I am so grateful. And these kids, it seems like we have to teach them, but also it's an amazing thing. Like, I have so much to learn from my daughter. And I try to notice and observe and catch all those things. But it's a lot, and it's hard, and it's very humbling for me. And to make music now, it's not about me. it's really definitely not about me. It's about everything else but me. I'm starting to realize that it's not about all the tricks I know or all the, you know, like we thought of Curtis as like Hogwarts back in the day, okay? And our teachers taught us classes, but some of us were like taught other things, like maybe, like if you think of them as spells, like maybe the dark arts. We were taught some dark arts, and for a long time, some of us were very obsessed with the dark arts, you know, because it seems very powerful in the moment. And musically too, these expressions exist. And a little bit extra sauce, a little extra vibrato, maybe a slide here, maybe a little grit here. You know, these things you become obsessed with when you're a kid because it's flashy, it's new, it's like your teachers, like you see them do it and it's like awesome, right? So you want to do it. But there's, now when I do, it's not like I forgot how to cast these spells, but when I do them, it means something different.
Bring you back into this conversation. You have been the recipient of a number of incredible awards, including the Sergei Rachmaninoff Award, which is given to one graduating pianist at Curtis each year. What did it mean for you to win that particular award? And I'm asking you that because I'm guessing maybe you have a soft spot for Rachmaninoff, who is featured on this recording.
I sure do. Rachmaninoff is one of my favorite composers, and he's special to pianists in particular because he was such a great pianist himself. Some people think he was the greatest pianist. We were fortunate that even though he was of a very much older generation, we towards the end of his life, we still have some recordings of him, very low quality old recordings, but it felt special to be close to be growing up in the city that he spent a lot of time with and recorded his own four piano concertos with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Eugene Ormandy. Or was it Stokowski? I think it might have been Stokowski. So this history and connection with the city and with Curtis, I think they wanted to name this award after that great pianist who spent so much time in the city and around them. And it was just an award that the piano faculty would decide to give to one pianist who graduated each year. I didn't talk with them to find out what the criteria were for this award, so I don't know what I did to earn it, but it was very special to me, and it was a great parting gift.
Sean, both you and Jonah have studied with some pretty incredible artists. I know one for you was Richard Good. And he referred to you as one of the most gifted pianists he's ever heard. What was it like studying with him?
It was incredible studying with him. I'm glad I didn't study with him when I was too young because he only teaches a few students. And I felt like my relationship with him was, he treated me as an equal and he gave me advice, but it was very much as if a friend who I very much respected, and of course I adore his playing, and he's such a great, kind person. I'm sure everybody would say the same. He would listen to me play, and he'd just tell me what he honestly thought and give me his feedback. And it didn't feel like he was trying to teach me a lesson or force some kind of interpretation of his own upon me, but it was just wonderful to have that opportunity to play for him for 2 years and just get his feedback on many different... I tried to play as many different composers as I could for him during that time, which was all too short. But I remember one time he used to teach at the Clavier House piano store in New York City. They would reserve their back room for him, and he'd just go there and use it kind of like an office. And he'd say, which Steinway do you want to play on today? They had a bunch of them and some Fazioli. So we'd choose a piano that we felt like. He said, I remember one day I walked in and he said, I've been playing this vintage Steinway that Gina Bachauer used to own. And it's very dark. Maybe it would be good for some Brahms for today. So we did that. And I remember one day I was playing and Emmanuel Axe walks in and he had paid a visit there to ask Richard Good a question about the second movement of Beethoven's third piano concerto, because he had so much respect for Richard Good's musicianship, particularly pertaining to this particular movement of the Beethoven concerto, of course. So he asked him how he felt about the Beethoven's indication to hold the pedal down for the entire first piano solo without lifting it. And that was a kind of a magical moment for me to just see these two guys talking in such a casual way right in front of me. I didn't mind the interruption to my lesson that day.
That, at first it sounded like a joke, right?
Yeah.
And Emmanuel Ax walks in.
Emmanuel Ax and Richard Good walk into a bar, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Jonah, you too have had some pretty phenomenal teachers. I noted that you've studied with the late Janos Starker and also Lynn Harrell, who recently passed away. Tell me a little bit about some of the memories you have of working with those two icons.
Yeah, I was very lucky to study with the great teachers that I studied with. From the beginning, I was extremely fortunate in never having a teacher who wasn't one of the greatest cellists ever. So my teachers from the beginning never let me practice badly or develop bad habits. It was from the beginning, no, this is the right way. And I don't care if you feel like you're gonna drop your bow, you're gonna do it right. And so here's a $5 Chinese bow. You can drop anytime you want. No, it was, we had a great time, but I was very blessed to have the best guidance. And even now, working with young students, I see like once you get a bad habit, it's so hard to break it. So I feel so fortunate. And my teachers, like, you know, Mr. Starker, Mr. Cole, Lynn Harrell, these guys, they all shared like an incredibly big heart. This is the thing they all had. And, you know, I studied with so many people, just at Curtis. I was maybe one of the first students that they felt comfortable passing around to all of the, you know, and sharing among the faculty. Because before that, it was like, if you even got a lesson with someone who wasn't your private instructor, you could get kicked out. Because they're very territorial, but I was like 10, 11 years old. And it's kind of like hard to get mad at a 10-year-old for wanting to play for someone, because I grew up listening to recordings of all my childhood. So me starting out on the Felix Salmon, Orlando Cole, Leonard Rose side of Curtis, and then also being able to study with David Sawyer and Peter Wiley and the Pablo Casals side, and also to have the Starker background and foundation, really for me, the technical foundation was laid down by Mr. Starker. He wrote this book called The Organized Method of String Playing, and he encouraged me to rethink and not just copy, but actually to be able to apply it and custom tailor it for my hands, for my arms, and for my playing style, which from the beginning, he said, look, Korean, Hungarian, these from the languages themselves are very different from almost anything else on the planet. You know, Latin languages, these, you know, Celtic languages, Russian languages, these, they're big family groups, right? But Korean and Hungarian don't belong to any. They only are related to one another, I think, and maybe Norwegian. They're called like Euro-Altaic languages, and they're very different structurally from most other languages. Now, he said, these things make us sort of culturally brothers, and so you must understand a lot of the things and the way I think about things. However, don't just blindly copy. Question and really and answer for yourself why I arrived at this, and see if you want to do the same thing or something else that works better for you. And so now in my mind, I have something that it's like I'm standing on his shoulders. So I feel like that. But Mr. Starker, I mean, in the beginning, in those days, I barely spoke English, and my father was busy running around doing his missionary work. So like there wasn't that much time in the family. So he was like a father to me in those days. And he not only taught me, but he practiced with me. I mean, I spent so much time in his house, and he would call it Starker Enterprises. And he had like this sign next to his swimming pool, and he would never miss the opportunity to say, oh yeah, the Kodai recording paid for this. It's so funny. But he had this outlook on life, and he really encouraged me and made me think, because he was one of my idols, really. So he said to me, look, you can really do this. Don't be so easily discouraged, because life is hard. Learning English too at the same time, going to regular school and all, it was hard, you know, and it was hard to fit in, learning how to make friends, all this stuff's hard. But he really gave me a lot of strength. And so I feel grateful for that.
One of the advantages you both had in studying at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia is you had a rare opportunity to study with the cellist who premiered Barber's Sonata for Violoncello and Piano Opus 6, Orlando Cole. He even worked on the composition with Barber when Barber was a student there. Tell me a little bit about what that was like. Because I know one of your goals is to be yourself, make your own statements. How does one do that when you're working with the person who premiered a work like that and also helped to compose it, basically?
Studying with Mr. Cole, every lesson was like walking into an encyclopedia. First of all, he had this great big blue music chest that he had inherited from Emanuel Feuermann, who every cellist reveres as Cassatt's rightful heir, who passed away too soon. But he's a great cellist, and he taught at Curtis briefly and left in his old studio his music collection and some records and a bunch of text too, which I have in my bookcase now. I have Feuermann's old Brahms double part with his handwriting in it, and along with like a stack of music. Like, it's incredible. But every lesson was like this. And on in a different pile, there was a Samuel Barber pile. I think at our first lesson, he pulled out a letter from, and he said, oh, this is from Sammy. He sent this to me the night after he wrote the Adagio. And it says, I think I did it. This slow movement is a real doozy. Words like doozy back in those days, but he knew he had written a hit, and he told me the story of the cello sonata and how they hung out at Dover Beach and the themes and what they mean and what childhood was like for them and the situation with the war and the draft and all this stuff. And to have that kind of context, life context, it goes beyond how, I mean, because we have the recording of Mr. Cole playing it with Billy Sokoloff. So we know how they played it, but the feelings that they were experiencing, they were trying to convey, to have this kind of original, this is what it was when it was conceived. It's really like a cheat sheet almost, you know, it's kind of amazing. Sean, how did you feel about art?
Yeah, those kinds of experiences were priceless, because with music, we have the printed score and we have recordings, but the performance practices that come from before that time, the only way it can ever be passed on is through oral tradition. And that was one of the great things about studying at Curtis, is that this long tradition existed there. And I think the motto and the idea of Curtis, at least at the time that we were there, their biggest thing was to uphold this tradition and pass it on to the next generation. So we were able to be part of that and experience it. And I think that translated very well into this particular program for the album with the Rachmaninoff and the Barber Sonatas.
Absolutely. You know, the cultural essence of the school, like everybody who goes through this process, there's an element to the voice that's different when the light's been passed on. It's a meaningful thing, the tradition.
Could each of you quickly share a moment within the Barber Sonata that is especially meaningful for you? And it might be different. You might each have a different section that you think, oh, be sure to listen to this.
Well, I don't think I can limit it to just one single moment that I find very special, but I'll give you a few. There's one short passage. It's not maybe the most thematically important passage in the first movement, but it's a transitionary passage in the first movement where the cello sustains these very pianissimo notes while the piano goes up and down in kind of spidery arpeggios. And I remember when we recorded it, we were trying to just get that to be as soft as possible, even softer than we'd ever play it in a performance, because when you record, the mics are so sensitive, you know, they pick up things that wouldn't quite work in a concert hall. So we tried to get it to the next level, and I think we got a very transparent filigree of sound there that whenever I hear it, kind of gives me the chills. On the other side, I like the A section of the second movement. I play him like chords there, and Jonah has a very heartfelt, almost anguished melody, and I also get the chills whenever I hear the way he played that. It was just perfect. I just love the way Jonah plays that. And then, of course, the passion of the last movement. There's a second theme in it where I get to play a solo that kind of reminds me of Lawrence of Arabia. That puts a smile on my face whenever I played that and hear it now.
It's so funny that you call it that, because remember, Mr. Cole used to call it that. The Lawrence of Arabia theme.
Oh, I didn't remember that, but I guess that's how he got that.
Mm-hmm. And he would make these movie references all the time, because, you know, as a child, like, what else did I know? So, to have these teachers, I mean, Mr. Cole was 90-something when we started studying with him. So many good moments in both these pieces, but you know, the thing that really sticks out for me is the humility of Mr. Cole, and he kind of communicated that to me in when he kind of explained the second movement to me and said, it didn't matter how many times I tried, there's this rhythm in that section that we could never get. So on this recording, we made sure to get that rhythm. Because Barber writes this very unusual rhythm where he divides 12 into...
It was triplets within triplets.
Exactly. It was like quarter triplets over four beats that are already divided into triplets. And Mr. Cole was full of things like this, and he would tell me stories. I think he knew that as soon as he told me that it was challenging and difficult, that I would work my butt off doing it, like to get it, right? There's so many good moments for me that are special because of the stories that my teachers told me. You know what I mean? Like, it means more.
The Rachmaninoff Sonata was written after his powerful Piano Concerto No. 2, and the sonata is somewhat related to that work. Can one of you explain that connection?
Yeah, without getting into too much detail, a lot of the figurations that, and maybe harmonic choices that he made, and even the melodic choices. And that's one of the things I think that made Rachmaninoff, one of his strong points as a composer, was just his sense of harmony and, of course, his beautiful melodies. For most composers, that's enough to make them a star, but he also had great counterpoint and a great structure. He had everything. And I think the way that he puts the harmonies and the melodies and the piano figuration itself really reminds me of his second piano concerto. One of the dangers is that the piano writing is so thick. I think technically it's probably about as difficult as the piano concerto itself. It's such a huge piano part that there's a danger of overwhelming the cello. But we were very careful about that, and I think we just got a review in the Gramophone magazine where they pointed out this exact potential problem, and luckily praised us that we're very happy that they liked the way we balanced the two parts, and I think it came out very well.
It was hard to find somebody to work on the Rachmaninoff with, and it's a big part. And yes, opus number-wise, I think it's 19, and piano concerto number 2 is 18. I submit to you that these composers, not just Rachmaninoff, but all the great ones, had kind of like a strategy thing going, okay? Because if you look at their compositional patterns, like Mendelssohn's, for example, he writes a bunch of songs without words, where you get like these nice, simple melodies, and then you get like sonatas with similar melodies, you get concertos with similar melodies, and then you get symphonies with these, you know, fully developed melodies. So it's like the same kind of thing. It's like they were smart, you know? So to have the Rachmaninoff and the sonata and the piano concerto and like all the information we have now on the internet, it's kind of impossible for me to not imagine him writing it at that same time. I almost think that maybe he wrote it first and then he said, oh, I need to make a big splash, piano concerto. You know, because come on, cello, piano, orchestra, chamber music. I mean, you get the idea. He wanted to make a big splash because what happened before that? His everything he wrote before that, it's like a chef again, right? I love to make these music food analogies because like Rachmaninoff was already really good at cooking, but he's like all these great ingredients you never had before. Check it out. Too much, man. And so he got all these bad reviews and they told him don't compose. And he's like, well, he gave it for a while. I think he really re-found himself, reinvented himself, and maybe like grew into what he, you know, like the story of the hero. There's always like the period when they suffer and then they rise up. So he rose up and he wrote these pieces and these themes. These are the themes that make Rachmaninoff. You know, and you listen to the middle theme in the third and the second movement of the cello sonata, it's straight out of the piano concerto.
To say, just in talking with the two of you in the last 40 minutes or so, you really seem like kind of the opposite of one another. I mean, is that how it is when you work together? Are you, Sean, are you more introspective and Jonah's much more extroverted, or is that just this interview?
I think personality-wise, that's definitely true. And I think that we bring a lot of complementary ideas to the table when we work together musically, though, that makes Jonah one of my favorite people ever to play with, is that, you know, being so different, yet having this history of playing together for decades and growing up together in Philadelphia, whenever, even if we haven't played with each other for a long time, coming back to it, it's everything just fits together almost automatically, as if we'd been rehearsing for weeks already. One moment when we were recording the Rachmaninoff Sonata and a theme or a tempo didn't somehow feel quite right. We were just trying to figure out what was happening with that, and Jonah said, let's just go back to that timing that we always used to do. And after he said that, we just, something kind of clicked, and we remembered how we used to play it years ago, and we did that, and it was perfect. So things like that are, I think, irreplaceable. These kinds of experiences that you just build up over the years.
It's like Sean said, you know, when you grow up together and you experience and you play together, over time, you trust one another. And that trust is irreplaceable. Sean, for me, enables me to play the way I play.
A new recording featuring the cello sonatas of Rachmaninoff and Barber with cellist Jonah Kim and pianist Sean Kennard. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, the producer of New Classical Tracks. I'm Julie Elmacher.